Hello, and welcome again to KHOI's Community Bookshelf. We are about to read the very last of Deborah Marquardt's book entitled The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere. It was published in 2006 by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group in New York. We are reading the epilogue, which is titled Sustainable Agriculture, The Farmer's Daughter Revisited. As we rejoin the book, the farmer's daughter is preparing a marijuana joint for herself and the traveling salesman, who has been told that he must spend the night in her room. "But don't you dare tell my father," she adds, smiling sideways at the traveling salesman as she flicks her lighter. The joint's tip flares in the black light. She inhales deeply, bringing the cherry to a bright glow. Then, holding her breath, she hands the joint to the traveling salesman. He takes it between his fingers, brings the paper to his lips, and inhales deeply. The farmer's daughter exhales, a blue smoke filling the space between them. They smile at each other as the sweet mustiness fills the room. At that moment, there's a loud knock on the bedroom door. It's a knock made by a big, hairy-knuckled fist attached to a big, beefy arm. The traveling salesman glances at the farmer's daughter in alarm. He rises to his feet, the smoldering roach between his fingers. Another knock comes. The door shakes on its hinges. A silence follows. "I'm okay," the farmer's daughter yells impatiently in the direction of the closed door and slaps her hand on the bedspread. Now the voice of the hired hand barks back through the doorframe. "I'm supposed to keep an eye out for anything funny." It's the hired hand's only spoken line and his one assigned task, to watch for signs of hanky-panky. "Well, there's nothing funny going on here," the farmer's daughter answers. She rolls her eyes at the traveling salesman. The hired hand listens at the doorway for a moment, then retreats down the hallway to his room. He has heard electric guitar music, and he will report it to the farmer in the morning. He believes he smelled incense burning. "I thought he'd never leave," the farmer's daughter says, when the hired hand's footsteps disappear. She turns and switches off the blacklight. Small bits of moonlight filter through the curtain, replacing the darkness. "Now, where were we?" she says, pulling the traveling salesman closer. She reaches for his face, begins to trace his worn and furrowed brow, the tired hollows of his eyes. "There, there," she says. She brings her lips to his cheek, tastes the oily softness of his skin. "There, there," she says in the darkness, her hands mapping his sinewy curves and ridges, which unravel and let loose their exhaustion as her fingers travel over them. The hours that follow are a tangle of sheets and limbs, of shifts, adjustments, and accommodations. To her surprise and her delight, she finds he follows simple instructions very well. "Yes, there. No, higher. Harder. Don't stop." And he never tires of being told what to do. She decides to always value this in a man. Toward morning, they settle into a rolling, dozing peacefulness. Between sleep and waking, they speak quietly of their disappointed fathers. She tells him she yearns to go to Paris, or New York, or Fargo. He speaks of his boyhood summers on his uncle's ranch in Wyoming, the smell of freshly mown hay, the satisfying heft of an alfalfa bale. "Do you know how to work a stick shift?" she asks. He props himself up on his elbow and chuckles, thinking it's some kind of kinky farmer's daughter sex talk. "I've been driving tractor since I was 8, he says. She smiles widely, her back turned to him in the darkness. In the earliest light of morning, the farmer's daughter slips out from under the traveling salesman's arm and gets dressed in the half-light. She goes down the hallway to the bathroom to brush her teeth and wash her face. As she flosses, her beautiful corn-fed reflection stares back at her in the mirror. The farmer and the hired hand, she knows, are already in the barn milking cows. On her way back to her bedroom, she sees the Winchester shotgun propped on its wooden stock in the hallway outside her door. Inside, she finds the traveling salesman sleeping peacefully on his side, the bedsheet pulled up around his waist. She lingers over him for a moment, observing the softness of his features in sleep, his olive skin, his full lips, his delicate, well-shaped ears. He is, she thinks, adorable in the early light. Even his small drool on the pillow almost breaks her heart. She resists the urge to crawl back into bed with him, to feel the warmth of his skin, the weight of his arm circled around her. Instead, she turns to her closet and retrieves her purse. She will take only a change of underwear and her small dial of pills. She rummages through the traveling salesman's suit coat, draped over the back of the chair just where he left it. She finds the ring of car keys in the right-hand pocket. Tiptoeing along the creaky hallway and down the wooden staircase, the farmer's daughter takes care not to wake the traveling salesman, who is actually awake, who has been awake since earliest light, listening to the first morning call of birds. As the door closes, he rolls on his back, stretches his long legs out before him, and props his hands behind his head. Through the open window, he can hear the cranky spark of the Buick's ignition as the farmer's daughter turns the key. The crunch of tires follows as he hears her put the car in gear and circle the gravel driveway. The traveling salesman smiles to himself, thinking that perhaps today, for all his trouble, the theft of the Buick, the irreplaceable loss of his product samples, the farmer will take him skeet shooting. In the car, the girl turns right at the section line and bears down on the accelerator, leaving a long trail of dust in her wake. If she looked back now, she would see the long, winding driveway and a white farmhouse surrounded by neat outbuildings and tall cottonwoods that seemed to stretch to the sky. If she looked back now, she would see her father in the doorway of the white barn, his hand raised to her in neither a fist nor a wave. And so agriculture sustains itself and is sustained. Section lines weave and crisscross at every turning. Traveling salesmen must be lost before they can be found. Hired hands secretly wish to be mechanics. Loaded shotguns are propped against doorways, but are never fired. Farmers do not mean to be so possessive. They're just punctuated that way. And farmers' daughters must struggle against the powerful apostrophes of their fathers. They must drive away some early spring morning, hands planted firmly on the wheel, convinced they will never look back. And that's the end of our book. Here are the acknowledgments. Special thanks to the editors of the following journals in which some of these chapters originally appeared, sometimes in different forms. Arts and Letters, Journal of Contemporary Culture. Brevity, Crab Orchard Review, Creative Nonfiction. Flyway, a literary review. Hayden's Ferry Review, Mid-American Review. New Letters, North Dakota Quarterly. Red Weather, Subterrain, South Dakota Review, The Sun Magazine. To Kill a Deer was reprinted in Dutiful Daughters, Reflecting on Our Parents as They Grow Old, edited by Jean Gould. Things Not Seen in a Rearview Mirror was reprinted in Pushcart Prize Anthology, 26, Best of the Small Presses. First, thanks go to the Department of English and the College of Liberal Arts and Sciences at Iowa State University, who have sustained me with research grants that allowed me to complete this work. A special thanks to the Iowa Arts Council, the Ragdale Foundation, the UCross Foundation, the Pearl Hogreef Fellowship, the Breadloaf Writers Conference, the Sewanee Writers Conference, and the Pirates Alley Faulkner Society for their support. I'm especially grateful to the following editors who first read and published these evolving chapters: Robert Stewart and James McKinley at New Letters, William Borden and Robert Lewis at North Dakota Quarterly, Stephen Pett at Flyway, a literary review, John Tribble and Allison Joseph at Crab Orchard Review, Karen Babine and Michael Cisnajewski at Mid-American Review, Dinty Moore at Brevity, and Martin Lamon at Arts and Letters, Journal of Contemporary Culture. Special thanks go to Susan Dingle at the North Dakota State Historical Library and Michael Miller at the North Dakota State University Library. Thanks also to Mark Gonzalez at the North Dakota State Geological Survey, Alan C. Ashworth and Gary C. Clamby at North Dakota State University, and Zora Zimmerman, Joanne McCoy, and James T. Andrews at Iowa State University. Any misinterpretation of the rich research they pointed me to is solely my responsibility. Thanks to my colleague, Neil Nakadate, for his literary analysis of farmer's daughter jokes, and to David Arneson for his revisionist fairy tale, Girl and Wolf, which served as an inspiring template for my revision of the farmer's daughter's fate. A special thanks to Philip Bryant, Barbara Crow, Roger Gipple, Cheryl St. Germain, and Lou Marquardt, my second cousin once removed, for their enthusiastic responses to early drafts. Thanks also to Donna Reeves Marquardt for offering her expertise on the tricky German-Russian dialect. I'm grateful to my friends at Minnesota State University Moorhead, especially Mark Vince and Tom Tomorrow, who edited an important anthology of Midwestern literature, Inheriting the Land. Long overdue thanks to my first writing teacher, Mr. James Olick, who demanded impeccable sentences. I'm also grateful to the following teachers and mentors whose work continues to inspire me: Jane Smiley, Scott Russell Sanders, Patricia Hampel, Alan Davis, Mary Swander, and Ted Kuser. Special thanks to my agent, Henry Dunnow, who believed that there was a place in the world for this book, to Megan Husted, who made a place in the world for it, to Carol Smith for her painstaking care with the manuscript, and to my editor, Amy Scheib, who arrived at the exhausted end with fresh horses. Finally, thanks to my family, especially my brother and my three sisters, with whom I share this story, and to my mother, who bravely continued to tell me stories even after she realized I was writing them down. My deepest love and gratitude go to them and to Thomas, Adam, and Gabriel Rice, who see me through and make it all matter. And we have quite a few more minutes left in this half hour of programming, so we are going to fill it with poetry by Deborah Marquardt. These poems are from her book, Everything's a Verb, Minnesota Voices Project No. 70, published by New Rivers Press, 1995. And this is the book about which she wrote in her story about her very first published book, of which she sent a copy to her parents and then never heard a word from them about it. This is the poem that she most worried about. I am upstairs trying to be quiet. When I think of her, I think of silence, my mouth growing tight across my face after she has told me not to sing in the house, not to move around so much. Told me she could fix dinner twice in the time it would take to show me once, what I would only forget and have to be shown again anyway, and how I would only make a mess that she would have to clean up later. I hear a cupboard door slam. She is in the kitchen with Father, talking about lazy kids. I am upstairs, trying to be quiet. Even though I'm safe in my room, with the door shut, I know she can still hear me breathing. Often now, when I dream at that place. Things follow me there I cannot stop. Street gangs, rock bands, Nazis. It's different every time. I hear them downstairs trashing the furniture, raiding the refrigerator, and leaving their scraps on the kitchen table. They are playing the stereo loud and having their women in her bedroom. I want to stop them, but there's nothing I can do. The sounds come to me like hard fists in my sleep. I am upstairs, trying to be quiet. Downstairs, they are tearing her limb from limb. You will recognize many of the people and circumstances in these poems if you have been listening to The Horizontal World. This one is called Speaking the Language. Again, the language fails me trying to describe her. Words fragment on my tongue. Vowels roll into tomatoes ripening on her windowsill. Consonants clatter and stack neatly in her cupboard. She taught me to speak this language. She said, "I am very exciting," meaning she was looking forward to something. She said, "Bodato," that small white vegetable she peeled each day, her hand riding high on the blade of a paring knife, her fingers permanently bent to the shape of a medium-sized potato. She said, "Upsy-daisy," pulling me to her large, round bosom long after I was too heavy to lift. She said, "That was good, not?" Meaning, "Don't you think so?" How do I decipher this language she left for me? These recipes for nepfia and strudel that never include flour. Flour being the ingredient too obvious for her to mention. These recipes that do not tell how many minutes to bake or at what temperature. Lost to me, all of it, like the magnet earrings she promised out of her jewelry box that were baubles in front and magnets in back, that did not pierce or clip, that held the earring to the lobe by some rare, invisible power. When the names still fit the faces. On a shelf in the back of the big closet after her death, we found stacks and stacks of photo albums full of her subjects. How many did she fool with her stammering, "Just a second," her fiddling, "This darn thing," her eye stalling for the perfect cinematic moment, that infinity of seconds when genuine smiles stretch thin and elastic, when loose arms thrown casually over shoulders grow heavy. The early photos feature plain women in fancy dresses and new cars parked by old houses. The later photos are thick with nyloned thighs, Christmas trees dripping with ornaments, uncles long dead, and children long grown old. Surely this is the trail she would have us follow, back to the people we would never know, the selves we would never recall. Back to the time when the names still fit the faces. In the end, fearing loss of memory, she took to labeling every photo, putting the name, finally, to the image, sprawling "Ed" across Ed's blank forehead, tracing "Reinhold" on a high, thin cheekbone, spiraling "Emma" up Emma's bleach blonde, beehive. She, the hand behind the shutter, is seldom pictured. Only in rare moments, when someone has seized the camera and forced her into the frame, does she appear, grinning, big-boned, and out of context, with a large me emblazoned across her bosom. Wormwood. My father tells the story he has told every day of his life, of the woman brought from the South where they still practiced the old ways, when Doc Simon said there was no hope because fluid was in both of his young lungs, how the uncles fetched her by carriage on the shortest day of winter, how she dug deep under tall banks for wormwood, a grayish, greenish, stinky weed that no one, not even the Herefords, would eat, how she boiled milk and dropped the leaves in, how she made a bitter soup for him to drink. Here my father sits back and breathes deep wormwood's tale. Little leaf, tiny slip, smuggled through customs years ago inside some washerwoman's sleeve. He has reached the border of what he knows. What lies beyond is unknown country, a tangled wilderness of sheets, soaked with sweat, cold rags pressed to a burning forehead, prayers whispering over him in the night. Beyond this point lives gossip, hearsay, the places only the body knows. Here my father's hands grow wings as if forming the story from air, the old blue veins tracing the slow curve of memory. They say she named the fever Little Fire and warned it to find a better place to burn. When lost, he invents details, the dozen eggs she took in payment for her work. But he always keeps the ending the same, how Doc Simon asked about him some weeks later, not seeing a notice of death in the news. How Grandpa said, wormwood. How Doc Simon said, that could have killed him. And who do you belong to? Even in my ghost costume, I'm recognizable with my three older sisters, the nun, the witch, and the pirate, who are only in it for the candy, and my brother, who believes he is Napoleon. It's not the question, and what are you supposed to be, that bothers me. Under my clean white sheet, it's apparent I'm a ghost. It's the other question, and who do you belong to, that sets our feet shuffling. Our answer, like a chicken bone, we hold in our throats, considering treachery, until finally the nun spits it out, our father's name. And that is when the wife calls the husband off the couch. The dog comes too, and even the parrot takes note. It's Felix's kids at their front door, mercy. We are the children of the year-round trickster. Felix, who pokes every chest for the invisible stain. Felix of, I got your nose, fame. And tonight we go door to door, forced to wait out the good laugh. And I begin to cry. I'm so tired of people laughing. And I cry straight through to the St. Philip's party when the sisters ask, how many jelly beans in this jar? I get weepy then because I only know up to 10. So my sister, the pirate, guesses for me, writing down one number less than her own guess, and I end up winning the whole goddamn jar. The permanent. The wind that blew me from the porch that afternoon came out of the dusty nowhere that is the high plains. My mother, inside, winding Grandma's fine feathers into pink permanent rollers, did not see the rock that knocked a hole in my skull, could not stop to watch the blood rush from the wound, only heard the wail wind up, the siren song that blew long after the gush had stopped, long after the rush of water, and my sister's shampooing hands had washed it all away. Mother applied the permanent solution, guaranteeing Grandma's curls were now a matter of record. The skunky smell of permanent drifted from the kitchen. The rotten egg odor permeated all the rooms. Grandma took me to her lap, that great lost continent of thigh. "Let me see," she said, tilting my cracked egg head to the side. "Oi, yoi, yoi," she clicked her tongue with regret. "Oi, yoi, yoi, that's going to be permanent." This next poem will be familiar to anyone who, like me, rode a school bus. Getting ready. I'm the thousand change girl, getting ready for school, standing in my bedroom, ripping pants and shirts from my body, trying dresses and skirts. My father at the bottom of the steps is yelling, "The bus is coming! Here comes the bus!" I'm wriggling into jeans, zippers grinding their teeth, buttons refusing their holes. My brother, dressed in 5 minutes, stands in the hallway, t-shirt and book bag, saying, "What's the big problem?" I'm kneeling in front of the closet, foraging for that great lost other shoe. Downstairs, my father offers advice. "Slacks," he's yelling. "Just put on some slacks." I'm in the mirror matching earrings, nervous fingers putting the back to the front. Downstairs, the bus is fuming in the yard, farm kits with cowlicks, sitting in rows. Everything's in a pile on the floor. After school, Mother will scream, "Get upstairs and hang up that mess." But I don't care. I'm the thousand change girl, trotting downstairs now, looking good, looking ready for school. Father, pulling back from the steps with disgust, giving me the once-over, saying, "Is that what you're wearing?" Doing the twist. Felix has 4 daughters, just like the Lennon sisters on the Lawrence Welk television show. Felix has 4 daughters, 2 altos and 2 sopranos, but wouldn't you know, Felix can't get those girls to stand together in a straight row, much less wear the same clothes. Felix says, "I've got 4 daughters for all the good it's doing me." One night, watching the TV, Felix calls into the kitchen, says, "Look here, girls, come and see this fellow dancing. Come and see this crazy chubby checkers." The girls crowd the doorway, watching Chubby grind out cigarettes on the Ed Sullivan Show. One by one, they drop their shoes. One by one, they drop their dish towels, and in their stocking feet, they try it. Careful at first on the hardwood floor, doing the twist. "What is going on?" Gladys calls from the kitchen, doing the dishes by herself. "They're busy," Felix yells. "They're doing the twist." After this, they do it for holidays and company, and whenever relatives come from California. Felix goes to Bismarck and buys the record, and damn if those girls can't dance, twisting in a diamond like all the points on a compass. The sopranos twisting high, the altos twisting low, and the youngest one, they say, is a regular dervish. And with that little taste of poetry, we are leaving the work of Deborah Marquardt. You have listened to her book, The Horizontal World, Growing Up Wild in the Middle of Nowhere, on KHOI's Community Bookshelf. Her book was published by Counterpoint, a member of the Perseus Books Group of New York, in 2006. I also read some poems from her poetry collection, Everything's a Verb. Professor Marquardt's the coordinator of the Creative Writing Program at Iowa State University, and she lives in Ames, Iowa. Next on the Community Bookshelf, you will hear an interview with Holly Burkhalter, the author of our next book, 4 Midwestern Sisters Christmas Book, which we will begin immediately after the interview. This is Mary Richards, producer of the program. Janet Kloss is assistant producer. Rick Morrison is chief engineer. We thank you for listening.